virtually. Promoters say online classes open up new possibilities for all kinds of students, advanced learners who need more challenging material not offered in their own districts, children who struggle with a particular subject who need to absorb the information at their own pace, young people with health problems who want to keep up with their peers while recovering, even students who are home because they've been suspended or expelled. But some observers are skeptical of virtual learning. They worry its potential benefits are being oversold, its potential drawbacks being ignored, and that some districts are using it just to save money without enough regard to the quality of instruction. Today in The Exchange, online education on the rise from kindergarten through high school. Let's hear from you. Has your child taken online classes? What do you see as the benefits and drawbacks of it? Could virtual schooling, in some cases, accomplish what traditional classrooms cannot? Or are we going overboard with online learning? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests. Amber Winkler, research director at the Fordham Institute in D.C., which looks at education policy. And Amber, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Mark Joyce, executive director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association and a trustee for the Virtual Learning Academy Charter School. And Mark Joyce, good to have you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Steve Kosakowski. He's CEO of the Virtual Learning Academy Charter School based in Exeter. And Steve, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Morning, Laura.
Well, and Steve, we could start with you since you're really the one hands-on doing this. So what are we talking about this here? How does this go beyond, you know, teachers and classrooms incorporating computers in the classroom?
Well, virtual learning has, or online learning has, kind of a long history, which people don't realize. It goes all the way back to the early 1900s and late 1800s, where people designed correspondence courses that, you know, would take place using the United States mail. And really, in the last decade, it's really matured beyond that correspondence course world. And the technology has allowed us at this point to really leverage things like voice and video and simulations, plus the traditional, you know, email and texting and so forth, to really provide a rich experience for kids. And I think a lot of times people have the image of perhaps a student in a dark room with, you know, nobody around working, and it's really anything but that. It's really about students being involved in a very rich curriculum, involved in activities that take them away from the computer, having a lot of communication with their instructors and a lot of communication with parents. And it's not a panacea. I think as we talk this hour, at least one of my strong feelings, is it should not replace the traditional classroom. That really there are strengths for both the traditional classroom and homeschooling, as well as virtual learning.
Well, and we'll get into some of the details of what you do there later on. But I'm just curious, Steve, so how many students are there full-time? They get their whole education from the Virtual Learning Academy. And how many are more hybrid students where, you know, let's say I live in a rural district that doesn't offer Chinese and I want to take Chinese so I can do that through the Virtual Learning Academy?
Yeah, right now we ended the year with 11,500 enrollments. And when we talk about enrollments, that's a half-credit enrollment or registration. About 95% of our kids are part-time. 5% are full-time, and translating that into real students, that's about 70 full-time students. But we have right now applications, about 100 applications for students who would like to become full-time.
So 95% of students are those who are trying to supplement their education in their traditional district or need more help than perhaps their traditional district can offer. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Mark, what do you see? How do you see virtual learning being used by regular bricks-and-mortar schools here in New Hampshire?
Well, I think it's been a very unique and valuable option that's been added to the choices that the state and local schools have in order to meet the educational needs of students. It allows students to, as you identified, either accelerate program, but also allows them to take courses that cannot be offered in their school. It also, a very important ingredient, allows a student to recover credits and to meet competencies that they may not have met in their regular program. As Steve said, it's really not made for all students, but it is an extraordinarily valuable investment by the state in enriching the options. And I would really call attention to how supportive the New Hampshire legislature has been in supporting this, because these courses are of no cost to parents or to the local school district. They're supported by the state educational trust fund.
So the state covers these courses?
Yes.
Wow. And you have called this, Mark, virtual learning. You said it's been a watershed moment that expands the scope of what education can be. That's pretty big language, Mark. Watershed. How come?
Well, I think it's one of those disruptive changes that has changed how people view the way that people can learn. And as Steve identified, it doesn't really replace the very important and monumental role that K-12 public education plays, but it does open up alternatives that did not exist before. As you may know, New Hampshire has moved its high school curriculum to be competency-based. And one of the interesting things that the virtual school offers is it meets those competencies one by one. In fact, it's quite an efficient model because the school isn't really reimbursed by the state unless the student meets the competency.
Amber Winkler at the Fordham Institute, I want to bring you into this too. And boy, just looking at the literature, lots of districts are incorporating this. What questions should school districts be asking, Amber, before they jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple, and I agree with both our other guests, that virtual learning is just a really exciting advent in education, and it's a really great way to meet the needs of kids that, you know, maybe can't get their needs met in the traditional district. But one question that we've not been able to answer and that we're still wrestling with in the virtual realm is, how do you monitor quality? So you've got all of these different providers who are, you know, providing services for kids. And in many cases, you know, they're just taking one course from a provider, but yet the school is still being held accountable for that child's performance with that course. So, you know, I think just big picture questions are, okay, you know, if you've got a bunch of different providers now educating kids, how do we hold discrete providers accountable for that child's performance? And how do we monitor quality? So, you know, obviously, just like traditional schools, there are going to be some providers that are really good at providing kids these, you know, the education. Some providers are going to be much better at teaching algebra than others. So how do we figure out, A, which are the better providers, and B, how we hold them accountable?
Well, and when you say providers, it's worth noting that these often are provided by private vendors, not, it's not like, you know, kids in the North Country are keying into a classroom in southern New Hampshire where they're teaching something that, you know, might be of interest.
Right. So, I mean, that's what the interesting thing about virtual learning, right? There's, in many cases, no geographic boundaries. So you could be living in New Hampshire and, you know, possibly be enrolled in the Florida virtual school. So, you know, so when we start talking, when we start thinking about, okay, that we're not limited by geography anymore and these kids are being, educated outside our borders, then the questions of quality and accountability become even more important.
Well, and Amber, a couple years back, the U.S. Department of Education warned that there's not much, I'm quoting here, not much scientific data showing virtual learning is any better than regular learning. And I wonder what you think, Amber.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an advocate of virtual learning. I think it's been difficult to do any really reliable studies on virtual learning because, again, we've seen it historically more in higher education than in K-12. But, you know, there have been a handful of studies that sort of, you know, look at mainly, you know, is it more effective to get an algebra course in person versus online? And in many cases, you know, they're just not well-designed studies. And I think that there are pros and cons to being in person and sitting at a computer, and it meets the needs of different kids. So I'm not as concerned about the question of which is better, online or in person. I'm more concerned about, okay, how are we going to wrestle with these really tough questions with this new, you know, advent in education.
All right, and let me give out the phone number, and then Mark and Steve definitely want your thoughts on that too. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at the rise in virtual learning in the K-12 school system. Has your child taken some online coursework as part of their education? What do you see as the benefits of that? Were there any drawbacks? Could virtual schooling for some students accomplish what traditional classrooms cannot? Are we in danger of going overboard with our enthusiasm for virtual learning? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Steve, what do you think? Again, the Department of Education said, you know, we don't really know if this is better than traditional classroom learning.
Right, and I would agree with the statements that Amber made. And, you know, I've looked at the same research studies. I mean, all of them have said it's at least as effective. But I do think there's debate as to, you know, when those studies were conducted and how the technology has changed and whether they were well designed and so forth. But I think what we do know is if it can be as effective, and certainly when we look at things like AP scores and state test scores for full-time students, we know that it's being at least as effective. I think what you want to do is then play to the strengths of virtual learning, and you also want to play to the strengths of traditional learning. And so in the virtual side, we can really personalize and customize and have one-to-one or small group relationships with students that can be difficult for schools that might have 20, 25, or 30 students or even more in a class. I think also we have a lot of flexibility in our model, which is not the same as other virtual school models. We allow students to enroll in a class at any time. We don't really have a school calendar. A student can enroll today or on Christmas Eve or at any time of the year. And also they can work at their own pace. They're held accountable for continuing to work, but if a student is a struggling math student and needs a full year to complete Algebra 1, that's fine as long as they're making progress and really working at it. And then you have the exceptional student that wants to complete algebra in 14 or 15 weeks, and that's fine too.
All right, and Steve, sorry to cut you off there. We will talk more after a very short break, and we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
Good morning. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 42 restaurants November 3rd to the 12th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. And from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, located in Nashua, Manchester, Londonderry, Amherst, Salem, and on the web at nhoc.com. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny for most of the state, highs in the lower 60s, partly sunny in the north country with highs there around 55 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows from 30 to 35 from the White Mountains north, 34 to 39 in central and southern parts of the state. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, highs 57 to 64. Wednesday, it'll be partly sunny, highs 60 to 65. And on Thursday, cloudy, a chance of showers, high temperatures in the 50s. This program was recorded earlier. We won't be taking any new phone calls today.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the rise of virtual learning. No longer just at colleges and universities. Now many K through 12 school districts are adopting online classes. Let's hear from you this hour. Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Do you have personal experience with virtual learning in the K through 12 system, either as an educator or parent of a child who participated in virtual learning? What did you see as the benefits? What did you see as the drawbacks? Again, our number on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange@nhpr.org. And Mark Joyce with the School Administrators Association. Just before the break, Steve and Amber were talking about the concern of how you measure or monitor quality as you expand learning to private providers, providers in other states. Mark, how do you make sure these classes are worthwhile?
Well, I agree with both of our other speakers in that those are open issues. From our perspective, let me address that from two points of view. First of all, as a trustee of the New Hampshire Virtual Learning Academy, I know, and Steve perhaps can talk some more about the selection criteria of the instructors, how they're trained, the fact that they're all New Hampshire certified, and the interactions are actually monitored and observed by the supervisors. From the school side, that was a big concern as high schools were embracing and considering this new option. That was a concern, and I would say very pleasantly so to date. The report from high schools and from school administrators is that they have been very pleased with the instruction that has occurred from the Virtual Learning Academy. That manifests itself, I think, both in teacher feedback of how well-prepared students are who completed a course and then moved into a second course in the high school, as well as the parent feedback Another unique aspect of the New Hampshire school is that parents are engaged with the teacher and with the student. So I think we have a couple of unique vehicles of feedback that have been favorable.
So who is accountable, as Amber asked, Mark, who is accountable for the results? If I take an online algebra class and I don't do well, is it the private provider who is held accountable? Is it my Concord School District? Who is it?
Well, in New Hampshire, it's the private provider if it's the Virtual Learning Academy, because they're not compensated, if you will, for the instruction of the course unless the student demonstrates competency, mastery. And I think Steve could give you a little more insight to how that's measured.
Well, and Steve, this may be a silly question, but, you know, we keep talking about accountable for learning the material. How do you monitor cheating? I mean, if I'm at home alone in my computer, what's to prevent me from, you know, sneaking the answers from my big brother who may be better at math than I am?
Sure. It's something that we discuss all the time. And I guess one of the things I would say prior to my answer about our school is that with the advent of the popularity in the Internet and 24/7 access, this is a problem I think that all schools are grappling with because, you can go out on the Internet and you can type in the name of a textbook and say, question on page 47, does anybody else have the answer?
Wow.
And somebody out there will say, yeah, I did that. You know, I worked on that last week, and here's the answer. Much the same as if anybody has experience as a high school teacher, you see kids kind of collaborating when they're, you know, in a cafeteria or a study hall or something. But obviously there's a line that can be crossed and it becomes cheating or plagiarism and so forth. So for our particular school, we have a number of things in place. One is the relationship between the student and the teacher, where there's constant communication. I often say that, if there's a student who's struggling with their writing and then overnight becomes Stephen King, you know that something has occurred.
Right.
Also, there's a lot of communication with the parent. And then what we also have on a regular basis are things that we call oral assessments, where the only way the student is going to complete the assessment is through a discussion with the instructor, where they can probe for understanding and so forth. So obviously if a student has been doing very well on four or five assessments and then knows nothing at the time of the oral assessments, that's going to be a red flag for us. We also use some online commercial software where you can submit our text or text anything. It can be mathematics, science, English, any of those areas, and you submit the text, and it searches a database and comes back and says, you know, we found that a certain percentage could be plagiarized.
Wow. So let me just make sure I got.
And also,
our
midterms and our finals are proctored.
I see.
We have a number of things that are in place to really try to counteract that.
Now, I'm interested in the oral part of what you said. So, if I live in Gorham and I'm doing a course or two with you, at some point, Steve, I have to come to Exeter and give an oral presentation so that you know whether I really have mastered the material or not.
No, good question. We have a number of online tools that we use, and it could be over a phone, it could be a video conference call, but it wouldn't be text. It would have to be the student actually speaking with the instructor.
All right. Well, lots more questions, but let's go to our callers. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions, comments, personal experiences with virtual learning in the K-12 system. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And in New Boston is Karina. Hi, Karina. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'm a homeschool evaluator. So I am a certified teacher. And this past spring here, I evaluated over 50 children. And that varies from K through 12. And quite a number of them, middle school, high school range, mostly did Virtual Learning Academy Charter School, the VLAX. And I found that, well, I personally have not used it yet with my children, but I have found from the parents' testimonies that they just absolutely loved it. It was a wonderful way to find an alternative source rather than going to the school and being there in person, but still able to take those academic courses and answer to someone who would have more knowledge, being that human figure, was a wonderful opportunity. They found that they loved the communication base, the structure of it, that the kids were assigned a certain thing. They didn't have to sit on the computer every single minute. They would go off and do an experiment or something in which their mother or father would help them with, or go off and do their writing and then come back to the computer and put their answers in, take their tests or put their essays in, so forth. And the parents really enjoyed the...
And Karine, I think we're losing your phone, and I really do apologize for cutting you off there. But Mark Joyce, this sounds like what Steve was talking about earlier. Children who are doing virtual learning aren't sitting on their duffs all day in front of the screen.
That's very true, and that's the feedback that we hear as trustees, and also the feedback that school staff receive from students. It's a very interactive process, and it's much different than I would honestly say my preconceived notion before I learned about it. I think one of the other really unique things as we reach out across the state of New Hampshire, in our case, is that students in our most geographically isolated places have that same quality of experience as a student at the academy who might live right in Exeter, meaning that the tools that Steve had spoken about, whether it's using live interactive video conferencing or telephone, are made available to them. And in some cases, when it might not be available in their home, the school is setting up a laboratory to allow them to use school equipment to be able to access this richer course offering.
Karine, thanks for the call. Again, our number on the exchange for your questions and comments about virtual learning is 1-800-892-6477. And let's go next to Manchester. Chris is on the air. Hi, Chris. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of quick points or observations. One, I'm a complete advocate of incorporating technology and virtual learning into the classroom. I think it offers more opportunities for educators to offer individual learning experiences for kids to help them really achieve their potential. But one of the concerns I have is, and having seen this going through the last school budget in my home community, is the conversation around incorporating online learning and virtual learning in place of teachers and looking at it as a way to lower costs by eliminating teacher positions and paraprofessional positions because the perception is kids can get the same quality education online and that we don't need as many teachers. And my concern is that our need for reducing spending is going to ultimately compromise our kids' education by seeing what is, I think, a valuable tool and employing it in a way that isn't using it to its best advantage.
Well, Chris, thanks for calling in. And boy, Amber Winkler, he's keying in on the concern that you see again and again and again in states around the country. Are we doing this because it's a good idea for our students, or are we doing this because we can get rid of teachers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's necessarily one or the other. I mean, I do think that, you know, people who are going about this appropriately and who are our most effective providers of online learning are actually very thoughtful in terms of, you know, hiring, as we've heard about, the best teachers. And yeah, I mean, actually, if a child can take, you know, chemistry from a Nobel Prize winner, and that instructor can reach, you know, five times as many kids as the local teacher at the local high school, I see that as a good thing for kids. So I think one of the things that we need to be careful about is, are we protecting adult interest or student interest? And, you know, I'm not like a proponent of firing a bunch of teachers. I'm a former high school teacher myself, but I am proponent of, if we are able to give a child a better instructor in a virtual learning environment than that child can get in their local district, then we owe it to that child to do that. So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the big advantages of online learning is to be able to take your most effective teachers, with the caveat that we can identify them, which we're getting closer with various models and growth and all these measures that we have in evaluating teachers now. If we can identify our best teachers and then amplify that teacher's reach, I mean, how exciting is that? That teacher who consistently takes students above and beyond grade level every year and adds to their growth every year, if we can amplify that teacher's reach two or three or four times than what they would be able to do in a traditional classroom, that's a huge advantage to kids. So I would just caution that, you know, we're not about firing a bunch of teachers, but that said, we are about protecting kids' interest over adults.
Well, and Chris, thanks for the call. And here's an email from Liz in Plymouth that's related, but she also makes another point, too, that I want to explore with you. Liz says, distance education has been so important in making education accessible for many years, and online technology has helped make distance education more engaging and impactful. However, Liz says, we should be concerned as citizens, parents, and educators about how much of the, quote, research about the necessity and effectiveness of online courses and other computer-related educational technology is actually driven and funded in no small part by the for-profit corporations who create and sell educational technology to school districts and universities. Their bottom line, she says, is profit, not learning. Liz says, let's pay attention to the players in this conversation. Let's be sure that the greater number of those on whom we rely to explain the benefits of educational technology don't have a vested financial interest in the expansion of online learning. What do you think about that, Mark Joyce? There's a profit motive here that's making some people nervous.
Well, I think all her points are very well taken, and I share them. I think one of the unique things about, well, your guests on today are that we don't have a personal profit-making interest in it. And what's interesting about the New Hampshire Virtual Learning Academy is that it is a state-sponsored charter school. It is a public school. And so it is very different in its motivation. Its mission is to serve New Hampshire's children, and it is nonprofit. It doesn't make a profit off it. And so I think those cautions are very well taken.
Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. We're a registered 501c3 nonprofit public school. I share some of the same concerns about the for-profit side of online learning. And I know there's some large companies out there that I think offer quality programs, as far as I know. I also know that, you know, they pay their CEOs, you know, more money than I'll probably see in my lifetime. And I know a lot of that money is coming from the public sector. And so I have questions about that.
So where do you get your materials, Steve? Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt,
me?
But I just want to clarify. So where do you get your learning materials? Are these different companies around the country, or are these educators in other states? Or where are you getting this material?
Yep. We did quite a bit of research on what we felt was the latest and greatest as far as the course material. And it's much like purchasing courses from a textbook vendor, if you will, obviously with a lot more interactivity and so forth. And so most of our courses come from another nonprofit. We have started to diversify a little bit and purchase from some small content providers. And we've even designed some of our own courses as well. And what we try to do is, you know, what's the best value? And there are times when it would cost more money for us to develop our own course than it would to buy a high-quality course that's been through, you know, a decade of different iterations and so forth. But one of the things I wanted to highlight when we talk about teacher jobs is, as far as I know, there's never been a teacher job lost because of our school. And in some ways, New Hampshire has protected against that with the charter school law, because it's all about parent choice. So a school district couldn't, for example, eliminate an English instructor and say, now you need to go to the Virtual Learning Academy to get your English, because the charter school law says the parent could say, no, I don't choose to do that. So what we are finding, though, is in this rough economy where there are districts who have had to face budget cuts and programming cuts as well, is that we can offer help, at least until they can get back on their feet with certain programs. So, again, I think, you know, there's the national scene and what might be happening. And I think New Hampshire and our legislators and policymakers have done a great job putting some protections in place.
Let's take another call. This is Kristen in West Chesterfield. Hi, Kristen. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I could probably go on for the rest of the hour, but my daughter was one of the first graduating classes of VLAC. She graduated not this past June, but the year before. And I will say that VLAC probably kept her in school. She was probably close to quitting. And so I'll hit on just some quick points. I know that the social aspect is going to come up. And I want to say that just because you're in a physical school with maybe 1,800 other students, that doesn't mean that you're getting any kind of social interaction. I mean, she was probably more alienated at her public school than at VLAC. She made a lot of friends at VLAC. She ended up meeting them in person. You'd hear her in one of their little virtual classrooms, and I'm being told to be quiet, and you hear them typing and then laughing and then doing something else and laughing. So they're actually really interacting. Just because they're not sitting next to each other physically, they're very much interacting, and they get to know each other. They also do interviews. They do group work. They had to do group work, even though it was long distance. The teachers are probably some of the most dedicated people. Even when I was ready to strangle my daughter when she was kind of getting backed up in the schoolwork, they would be, it's okay, this is normal. They're learning to set their own time schedules, and this is, just relax, Mom. And and she graduated. So, it took her a year and a half to do her junior year, and it took her 5 months to do her senior year. So,
well, Kristen, real quick, because we're going into a break, just why did your daughter have to go from the regular public school to the Virtual Learning Academy, VLAX?
She just, she was frustrated by the teacher. She wasn't getting, she had to meet on their time schedule, and these teachers are available any time of day. She had trouble with the social scene in the high school, so this was perfect. She met a lot of kids like her and different than her, but they weren't judging her, and that made the huge difference.
All right. Thanks for calling, and we're going to go into a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of those points. Thanks for bringing those up, Kristen. Our number, if you want to join us, is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, we're taking your questions, comments, personal experiences with virtual learning. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, and we'll be right back.
The history of immigration in New Hampshire goes back a long way. In 1900, about 40% of our population was immigrants. Next week, we'll continue our year-long look at that history, as well as more recent trends in immigration, its effects on our health care and education systems, and the obstacles immigrants and refugees have to overcome as they begin to put down roots. Tune into The Exchange, as well as stories from word of mouth and our news team, all next week as we tackle the many issues surrounding immigration.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from Summit Wealth Group, specializing in retirement distribution strategies for the generation nearing retirement. Information at summitwg.com. And Capital Center for the Arts in Concord presenting In Concert Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, the original lineup, Sunday, November 20th at 7:30 p.m., tickets at ccanh.com. More on the rise of online learning on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, new perils facing the Eurozone. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny across most of the state, highs in the lower 60s. It'll be partly sunny for the North Country, highs around 55. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows from 30 to 35 from the White Mountains north, 34 to 39 in central and southern parts of the state. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with highs 57 to 64. Partly sunny Wednesday, highs 60 to 65 degrees. This program was recorded earlier. We won't be taking any new phone calls this morning.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how virtual learning is being used in public schools around the country and here in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. Has your child taken some online coursework as part of their education? What do you see as the benefits of it? What about the drawbacks? Could virtual schooling in some cases accomplish what traditional classrooms cannot? Is there a danger of going overboard with virtual learning? Give us your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, before we go back to the calls, Amber Winkler, I did want to return to Kristen's point, who called in just a moment ago. She said, the preconceived notion that you have is that you're not getting any socialization, but her daughter actually made some great friends going to the Virtual Learning Academy. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think we're seeing the virtual learning community sort of take a cue from the homeschooling movement, which is, kids are still getting together on their own, for projects. They're using Skype, you know, to be able to see each other. They're having phone conversations where they have calls and discuss, you know, collaborative projects. So I absolutely agree. I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of interaction. It just looks different from what most of us are used to in our own schooling. But absolutely, they've been able to still meet kids' social needs in the online venue.
All right. Well, let's take another call. This is Vicki in Newport. Hi, Vicki. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to talk about the technology from the elementary perspective. I'm an elementary school technology integrator, and I'm not an early adopter. I really wait to look and see what the software is like before I buy it. And I found that the quality of the educational software has really improved over the last couple of years. It used to be just digital worksheets or games, and now the software that we can get is really safe, engaging, and self-paced. And I always buy the software that has home access so that my kids can get the access to this digital learning at home as well as in school.
So, Vicki, are you incorporating then some type of e-learning or online learning as part of your regular classroom when the kids go home?
Well, I'm the librarian and the technology integrator, so I don't have a classroom.
I see. I'm sorry. Right.
But many, many of my students use, we have a subscription to a software called Big Universe, which is 30,000 books available digitally.
Wow.
So kids who don't have books at home, high-quality fiction, nonfiction books that they can get to at home. And parents talk to me in the line at the grocery store and say, oh, I love that digital Big Universe. My kids read it all the time.
You know, is there a downside, Vicki, to virtual learning that you can see?
Not in the software I use at the elementary level. I know my daughter did some of the digital learning in high school. And it was okay. The proctor in the lab wasn't really able to help when kids had confusions. And then I did my master's at Plymouth, and some of it was hybrid, and one of it was all online. And I really missed, with the all online one, I really missed the classroom discussions. We met once a month, and so the fully online, I wouldn't go that way, but a supplemental materials for children to use on their own, I really think it's important.
Well, thanks for calling, Vicki, and it gets to what everybody's been saying about this is not in any way, shape, or form a complete replacement for that traditional experience. Steve, in your opinion, are there times when virtual learning doesn't work? For example, what about dissecting a worm or a frog in biology?
Well, I think actually that's an area where it works quite well.
Really?
I mean, one of the things I think we have to realize is that when you talk about science labs and so forth, is where we have kids participate in labs so that they obviously can learn something. But we're not preparing them to be scientists. And I think definitely once kids get into the post-secondary arena, they should have hands-on, and they should understand chemical interactions by seeing them. But We basically take a balanced approach. We do send out science kits so the kids are involved in actually doing some things hands-on, but then we do a lot of virtual simulations. And I think part of the advantage of an online simulation is it takes some of the controls and safety concerns away. And, for example, in a chemistry course, students in a virtual lab can add different chemicals to see what happens, whereas you'd never allow that to happen in a regular
because it would blow up.
You know, and as far as the dissection goes, you can perform that online as well. But certainly, when you mentioned, yeah, there are times when it doesn't work. Again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's not a cure-all for all ills. If you have a student that really is having severe difficulty and won't participate in traditional education, won't participate in online education, it's not going to change that. And sometimes we have to bring a lot of resources to bear to help those kids. So, you know, it's not a perfect mode of learning, and neither is a traditional classroom. And I think that's what we're learning, is we want to have many alternatives for kids so that they can pick what best fits their needs.
Mark Joyce, what about the idea of an animated, wide-ranging classroom discussion where, you know, 22 10th graders are sitting around talking about, you know, the book that they were assigned in class. I mean, do you miss out on that with virtual learning if we go too far with this?
If we go too far to the absolute elimination, you're right. That would be a great loss. I think what's interesting to me is how we tend to look at this from the adult point of view.
Uh-huh.
Now, you know, I've had 40 years in the business, and my frame of reference is to look at how I learned and how I like to learn. But I think one of the underlying points when the parents have called in is that kids today learn differently and they're comfortable doing things that perhaps I still am not comfortable doing. And so they have these kinds of rich conversations with their friends online all the time. They're used to being fully connected to an unlimited resource of information. Now, that's still a little strange to me, personally. You know, I'm learning more and more about that. But I think one of the ingredients that makes the virtual learning different for this generation of students is they come to it with an entire different set of skills and experiences than I did so many years ago.
Let's take another call. This is Colin in Merrimack. Colin, thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. I actually took a virtual learning class my last semester of high school for credit recovery because I had failed first semester. And I was taking it while I was still going to school. It was great because I could set my own pace. And it helped me graduate, and it was great for that purpose.
How was it better than the way the material was originally presented to you, Colin? How did it help you pass that course, whereas before you'd struggled with it?
Well, it wasn't really any differently organized than in the classroom, but it did give me a second chance. I didn't have to go to summer school. I could do it concurrently with my second semester of English.
All right, Colin. Yeah, oh, go ahead. Did you want to say something else there? Yeah.
And, it was just, it was really a lifesaver because I was able to graduate on time and everything.
Right. And, you know, thanks for calling in, Colin. Steve Kosakowski, we've heard stories like this. You know, people have different situations. They struggle with a certain subject. Maybe they, you know, have an accident or a health problem and they don't want to fall behind their peers. I mean, there are all kinds of different situations where this can apply.
Sure. And one of the things I think people look for an answer is what's the stereotypical student who wants to take an online class? And what we found is there isn't an answer, that there are kids all across the board. You can have kids who are very advanced and kids who are struggling and all those in between. What's interesting is we survey all of our students when they come in. We ask them a short series of questions. And one is, you know, why are you here? And we were surprised to find that well over 50% of our kids identified at least one high risk area or an area that put them at risk, whether they failed the course or not in danger of not passing or graduating from school. But then we also know that well over 20% of our kids are on that high end, and then there are other kids who are in between. And so it's interesting as we go forward that I think it's harder and harder to identify a stereotype for students. Also, I think a lot of schools, there are some schools that have an application process that basically say, are you highly organized? Are you highly motivated? They're kind of looking for the perfect student, whereas we look at it a little differently and say, we don't expect all adolescents to be highly organized and highly motivated and so forth, and that's part of what we want to do is help teach them to become independent learners as they move forward.
Colin, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in. And let's go to Derry next, where Andrew's on the air. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to touch up on a topic earlier that I heard about the socialization of adolescents, and in regards to internet courses and virtual courses and things of that nature, I think it's a terrific idea that you're able to do that, because when adolescents are, you know, collaborating online and everything, they're getting the basic fundamentals of all the knowledge that they need, where they lack some minor socialization skills. I think bullying, although it is a huge topic nowadays, I think it's also somewhat a necessity, at least to a certain degree, not to the degree that is being portrayed on the media. But also, children are still able to get their socialization through other activities, like extracurricular activities and recreation centers and things of that nature.
So you don't see kids losing out on socialization with too much online learning, Andrew, or do you?
I think it's 50-50. They get certain socialization aspects that they need in regards to, like, ambitions in schooling and things of that nature, but they're also lacking on the reality of independent lifestyles, which I think is also a necessity because not everybody is going to be so eager to learn and so eager to collaborate with you. And I think that's, you know, a reality check that sometimes kids need to experience on their own. And like I said, I think bullying is a very negative thing. It needs to be taken down a notch. But even, like, you know, with your friends, the small puns and everything, I think that still can contribute to the whole bullying aspect that is a necessity, I feel.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. And Amber Winkler, what do you think? This whole socialization piece that we keep coming back to.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I think it's mostly been met. You know, I think that folks have found a way to sort of get that itch scratched, so to speak. And I also think, you know, his point about, you know, some kids aren't as motivated. There's some cases in which a child will literally go to the traditional school building for an online class and just have a facilitator, a teacher sort of peeking over the shoulder and checking in, not the teacher of the course of record, so to speak, but just someone there to sort of, you know, do some hand-holding. And that's a kind of a neat advent. I mean, talking about jobs, I mean, maybe what it is that we're going to see, it's not traditional teacher jobs, you know, this is a biology teacher or whatnot. It might be more of a facilitator role or someone, you know, who kind of performs as an assistant or a secondary role that wouldn't necessarily have to have full teacher accreditation because they don't teach biology per se, but they form, you know, more of a teacher assistant position. And maybe we'll see more of those types of jobs for those who are concerned about, you know, losing jobs. Maybe those roles will continue to, you know, sort of evolve as online learning continues to expand.
And let's take one more. This is Bob waiting in Bow. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. A couple of thoughts here. I really enjoyed this conversation a whole lot. Several quick thoughts here. One is that effective online learning really requires that the educator pay attention to the climate in the classroom, if you will. In other words, if they don't make students feel safe and welcome, it's not going to be effective. There's lots of research that shows that. Whereas in a face-to-face classroom, there's every possibility that a student can be participating in the class physically, but their mind could be, you know, on Mars, and you can't tell if they're engaged. Whereas online, know if they're engaged or not because they're responding, they're engaging, they're asking students other questions. There's lots of ways of finding out that they're working together. And I would say that, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up on us, Bob, so I'll have to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay, wrap it up real quick. A friend of mine, Ray Rhodes, started the first online high school in the country called the Virtual High School out of Concord, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the, what he calls face-to-face bigotry, which is the assumption that face-to-face is inherently better than online. And his point is that there's a lot of research that shows that that's absolutely not true. And he tells a point, which is the last point of Thomas, that if you're a student whose appearance makes other kids not pay attention to you in a face-to-face classroom, online, all of a sudden, they're responding to the quality of your ideas and your insights.
Instead of your clothes or what you look like or your voice or your mannerisms.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob, I'm going to let you go because we're heading out towards the end of the show, but I really appreciate the call. And, you know, Amber, this is not a term I've heard before, so thanks for that, Bob. Face-to-face bigotry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. You know, we hear a lot of that. You know, and your last caller made the point, too. Sometimes you see less bullying. You know, we hear bullying online, but bullying as a result of, you know, what you look like or, you know, what, how you dress. I mean, obviously that's ameliorated in an online platform. And yeah, sometimes the quote unquote nerdy kids, you know, are getting a lot more respect, so to speak, online. And yeah, I think that's a little known advantage that we don't often hear about. You know, we talk more, as I did at the beginning of the show, about quality and accountability, which is, you know, really important for these programs. You know, how do we measure, you know, who's doing a better job? And we can, and some of these great points that some of the callers have made, the socialization, you know, the convenience of online learning, all these things that we know intuitively make a lot of sense. But now, how in the world can we capture this so parents can go online and say, hey, big universe, actually, the kids who use Big Universe do a lot better. They learn to read faster than if you use this X online program. And if we can ever get to the point where we can collect really reliable data for parents to go online and see for themselves, let's be really transparent about what providers are doing and the results that they're posting, I think that we can move the ball even, you know, more forward in terms of the research.
That quality control piece you talked about. Amber, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it. That's Amber Winkler, Research Director at the Fordham Institute in D.C. Mark Joyce, good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Have a great day.
Mark Joyce, Executive Director of the New Hampshire School Administrators Association, and Steve Kosakowski, thank you also for being here.
You're very welcome.
Steve Kosakowski, CEO of the Virtual Learning Academy. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineers, Dan Colgan. Our producers, Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns, Ryan Lassard. The Exchange Executive Producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the history of immigration law. Although we're a nation of immigrants, the first laws to enforce who could come to America didn't appear until the 1880s. Since then, these rules have been tightened and loosened. As part of our year-long look at immigration in New Hampshire, we'll talk about the law, how it's evolved, and ask if it once again needs to be modified. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our members. And support also comes to us from the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting Backstage Pass Rock and Roll Photography, featuring rare behind-the-scenes photos now through January. Details at courier.org. And Tracy Banks Saab in Concord introducing the new redesigned Saab 9.5 sedan, a turbocharged luxury sports sedan for the independent thinker. TracyBanksSaab.com. Saab, move your mind. These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, WEVO Concord, 89.1, WEVS Nashua, 88.3, WEVH Hanover, 91.3, WEVN Keene, 90.7, WEVC Gorham, 107.1.